explain the matter to them, testifying to the kingdom of God and trying to convince them about Jesus, both from the law of Moses and from the prophets. Some were convinced by what he had said, while others refused to believe. So they disagreed with each other, and as they were leaving, Paul made one further statement. The Holy Spirit was right in saying to your ancestors through the prophet Isaiah, go to this people and say, you will indeed listen, but never understand, and you will indeed look, but never perceive. For this people's heart has grown dull, and their ears are hard of hearing, and they have shut their eyes so that they might not look with their eyes, and listen with their ears, and understand with their heart, and turn, and I would heal them. Let it be known to you, then, that this salvation of God has been sent to the Gentiles. They will listen. He lived there 2 whole years at his own expense and welcomed all who came to him, proclaiming the kingdom of God and teaching about the Lord Jesus Christ with all boldness and without hindrance.
Responses to this section, what jumps out at you?
Sounds like people today.
Which part sounds like people today?
Doesn't listen.
Doesn't listen.
And they look but they don't see, and their hearts. Those verses are true.
Okay.
I was thinking that it sounded like myself.
Okay. Sounded like myself, she says. Okay. Jim?
I found myself thinking of Bonhoeffer, who found the church not in those that were supposed to be in the church, but in those that were outside of the church, that were doing the works of justice and trying to bring about peace and to fight the war. You know, so let it be known to you that then that the salvation of God has been sent to the Gentiles, that they will listen.
Yeah.
So maybe work on it. Maybe there's a different church.
Following on what Jim says, I thought of the way in which the church has been received and the word has been listened to by people in Africa and Asia and Latin America, much more than here on the part of those who like to think of ourselves as having carried the word there.
Yeah, I experience, I preach regularly in Anglo churches and on Sunday mornings, but most of my ministry is in the jail, and in the jail, and outside the jail, among people that are outsiders, complete outsiders to the church, people are listening. You know, and they're very open. But in the church, it's a different story.
Yeah, right.
So I think that we've taken the place of Israel.
You stole my thunder again.
It says down here that let it be known to you then that this salvation of God has been sent to the Gentiles, and they will listen.
Yeah. See, this obviously, this is the church trying to puzzle over what's going on in terms of its of leaving the womb of Israel. And so this provides, in essence, kind of the closing remarks, I think, of Luke's reflection on this matter. The way I want to read it, Bob has already indicated, we now stand, I believe, in the place of the Jews in this account. In other words, we are the ones to whom the message has been entrusted, and the question then that I want to press is, are we listening? Because the whole thrust of what I think Luke Acts is about is that God is going to have his witnesses and his listeners. And the question is whether we will hear these for ourselves. Because almost universally the reaction of the church is to hear this for somebody else. It's those folks who aren't listening. And until we begin to understand, I think, the precariousness of our own situation as being the Israel of this, in this story, I think we're in danger of not hearing. Okay? I mean, that's the thesis. It could be totally wrong, and as much of my stuff is. And the other, you know, the other thing I probably should say, this is a little digression, but I tell my people in the Bible studies I do in Port Angeles, whatever you do, don't take what I say to the bank. Because I may change my mind tomorrow. I may find something that says, oh, how did you ever hold that position? But I want, you know, I want to try to read this for myself and encourage each of us to, not only personally, but as community, to read, to see what it is that God is saying to us as we try to be responsive listeners, hearers of God's word. So that's the thesis that I want to pull out, and I see the storyline, the narrative of Luke Acts moving to this place. Now I want to go back to the beginning of the gospel and kind of trace in a very rapid fashion, much more rapidly than I would want to, but again, I want to see this only as introduction to try to puzzle through how we might read this for ourselves. I also need to tell you that my interpretive, one of the interpretive guides for me is actually, of all things, a Norwegian biblical scholar, and I don't know very many. I read many years ago Jacob Jerevel, who argues for me convincingly that that you'll notice in Luke there's never a new Israel. There is one continuing Israel of God. And so that you do not have this split between Jew and Gentile, in even though we're talking here at the end of this about Gentiles listening, they will in essence become the Israel of God, the people of God. But if you read the book of Acts carefully, you will find both rejection and acceptance on the part of Israel. Never does all of Israel reject the message. Never does all of Israel quit listening. Another further digression. You'll notice in your, I've already had you turn away from it, but if you look carefully at the at Acts 28, you'll notice that our new RSV has verse 28 and then it has verse 30, and verse 29 is in the footnotes. In looking in my Greek Testament, and I use the American Bible Society's Testament rather than Nestle Allen, but simply because, given the level of my scholarship, the ASB does just fine, or the ABS does just fine. But when you look at the manuscripts cited for the inclusion of that, none of them are before the 9th century. And I think it shows evidence of the anti-Semitism that has some of its origins right here when we come to the end of the book of Acts. Yeah. We're also going to talk about how the book of Isaiah has been used in an anti-Semitic way tomorrow. And I might tell you, if you want to get ready for tomorrow, you wouldn't even have to come to class tomorrow if you want to go by the other book I recommend in there, Isaiah's fifth gospel. They got a whole stack of them in the bookstore, and it is a beautiful book. It even feels good. It does. Just pick it up. It just feels good. And it's a wonderful kind of suggestion about some things. Okay, back to the book of Acts. Now, when we open the book of Luke, we couldn't be more in the First Testament. We are so thoroughly in the First Testament. I mean, it just drips with the life and pulse of the First Testament. We meet characters whose names and whose occupations and everything are right out of the First Testament. Elizabeth, Zechariah, Miriam, or Mary. And what we have is a visitation of these people, and so the first actor on the scene is Zechariah, who is a priest who's gone down to do his priestly duties. And the angel Gabriel comes to him and speaks to him. And so we're going to run through this quickly. And he doesn't quite hear all of the message that Gabriel gives him. And so if you would look for just a moment beginning at, say, verse 18 of chapter 1. Zechariah said to the angel, "How will I know that this is so? For I am an old man and my wife is getting on in years." Clue number one, he should have gotten it. We've had some old men and old women having kids before, right? In the Old Testament. The angel replied, "I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God, and I've been sent to speak to you and to bring you this good news. But now, because you did not believe my words, which will be fulfilled in their time, you will become mute, unable to speak until the day these things occur." First hearer. Second hearer, Mary. Notice both hearers in these first things. The first thing the angel says to them is, "Do not be afraid." Isaiah likes that phrase a lot. Do not be afraid. Okay, so now we move over to verse 26 and following. And we know this from the Magnificat, especially from the Holden Vespers and all of that. And so she gets this greetings, favored one, the Lord is with you. And then verse 29, but she was much perplexed by these words and pondered what sort of greeting this might be. The angel said to her, "Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God." And then she's given all of this kind of thing. And her response is then in verse 38, "Here I am, the servant of the Lord. Let it be with me according to your word." Second hearer listens. Third hearer, chapter 2. We hear it every Christmas. It's peasants, shepherds in the field. The angel appears to them. First words, "Do not be afraid." Three times already. "Do not be afraid." And then what do these hearers do with the word they receive? They run to find out what the words are about. And then in good typical First Testament imagery, we know that they got the message because they returned glorifying and praising God for all that they'd seen and heard, just as it had been told them. See, in the First Testament, Klaus Westermann makes this point just wonderfully, I think. You very, very seldom have anybody in the First Testament to whom faith is ever attributed. What, Genesis 15:6 or whatever, Abraham believed God and it was reckoned him as righteousness or whatever. But everywhere else, the only way you know whether folks have faith or not is that they praise God. That's the motion, that's the movement of faith for the First Testament, right?
Well, Abraham, Genesis 12, it just says he goes.
Yeah, or response. Okay, obedience would be another key. But the point is, they do what they've been told and they return thanking and praising God. So the third hearers get it. Then we have Simeon, and we have Anna in the the prophet Anna, who also gets it. So we have an interesting introduction to people who hear the word that comes to them, and so the book launches, I think, with announcement and with kind of a profile of hearers. Now, because we're going to be skipping along with some rapidity in order to get to try to make this case, move to chapter 5 for a moment. Once, while Jesus was standing beside the lake, this is verse 1, the lake of Gennesaret, and the crowd was pressing in on him to hear the word of God, and so then he gets into the two boats, or the boats that were there, And then I want to skip down and to verse 10, the second sentence in that verse. Then Jesus said to Simon, "Do not be afraid. From now on you will be catching people." When they had brought their boats to the shore, they left everything and followed him. Luke loves the little Greek word punta, everything, all. And it's a very threatening word.
It is.
It is. Very threatening. Now I want to skip over to chapter 6. And I think this one is good enough. We'll have somebody, we'll pause here momentarily. This shows that some of my sense of living in world two, for those of you in theological worlds. But I'd like to ask someone to please read verses 27 through 38.
Woe to you when all speak well of
you.
No,
this is chapter 6, verse 27, excuse me. Oh.
But I say to you that listen, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. If anyone strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also, and from anyone who takes away your coat, do not withhold even your shirt. Give to everyone who begs from you, and if anyone takes away your goods, do not ask for them again. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. If you lend to those from whom you hope to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much again. But love your enemies, do good, and lend, expecting nothing in return. Your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your lap, for the measure you give will be the measure you get back.
Okay, we'll just pause for a moment. Any response to this section?
Sounds pretty ultimate to me.
He wants us to listen.
Right. I think, and this is my little thesis here, that when Luke uses the word listen, it's listening time. And it's probably hard stuff to listen to. But I say to you that listen, love your enemies. Now, again, just to briefly connect a little dot with the rise of Christianity. And this is way oversimplified, but I just want it to be suggestive and provocative. Rodney Stark claims that no religious movement grows on the basis of, first of all, because of its theology. That's not what attracts people. That's not what makes people Moonies or Mormons or whatever. It's a sense of community that they're invited into. Now, at the second level, the theology informs and shapes that. But you do not argue people into the kingdom basically by handing them the ABCs of getting Jesus. But rather, some kind of theology that makes this a welcoming community. And his contention is that the way the Christians cared for one another and for their neighbors during two major plagues in the ancient world started to give the Christian movement a leg up. Now, obviously, once you get inside, then the theology starts to inform at a better. And this, I think, is the kind of theology that informs a community that would be very attractive. right? Okay, anything, any, it'd be scary right at the first. You got two coats? Well, we'll take one of them. Thank you very much. How many shoes you got in your closet? Well, Imelda, we'll take a few of those. And this is so consistent because when we get done with Pentecost in the book of Acts, what do we find those crazy people doing?
Sharing what they have received.
Yeah. No one said what belonged to them was their own. But as needs arose, they sold what was theirs and made it available to the community. Maybe we should just stop listening now. Okay. And the key, there's a couple things. I love this stuff even if I don't live there. I'll not even put often. I'll just say don't live there. Look at verse 35 and following for just a moment with me. But love your enemies. That's the second time we've heard that. But love your enemies, do good, lend, and expect nothing in return, and see First Bank and go out of business. But your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High. And here's where I get in now. This next phrase lets me in. For he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. Doesn't mean we're left there. And then this wonderful statement, be merciful just as your Father is merciful. When Matthew quotes this stuff, he says, be perfect. But of course, the word he uses can mean to be fully mature. Very interesting. To be fully mature is to be compassionate, merciful, as God is compassionate, merciful. Aha! You know, the way we are most like God is in our generosity. And this is to be that kind of community of generosity and compassion. Okay, so that's what that would mean listening in this sense. Okay, let's read the rest of this chapter, please. Verses 39 to the end.
He also told them a parable. Can a blind person guide a blind person? Will not both fall into a pit? A disciple is not above the teacher, but everyone who is fully qualified will be like the teacher. Why do you see the speck in your neighbor's eye, but do not notice the log in your own eye? Or how can you say to your neighbor, friend, let me take off the speck in your eye, when you yourself do not see the log in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your neighbor's eye. No good tree bears bad fruit. Nor again does a bad tree bear good fruit, for each tree is known by its own fruit. Figs are not gathered from thorns, nor are grapes picked from a bramble bush. The good person out of the good treasure of the heart produces good, and the evil person out of evil treasure produces evil, for it is out of the abundance of the heart that the mouth speaks. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I tell you? I will show you what someone is like who comes to me, hears my words, and acts on them. That one is like a man building a house who dug deeply and laid the foundation on rock. When a flood arose, the river burst against that house, but could not shake it because it had been well built. But the one who hears and does not act, it's like a man who built a house on the ground without a foundation. When the river burst against it, immediately it fell, and great was the ruin of that house.
Okay. Again, any responses that you have to what you hear in these words? Jim?
So much for do not be afraid.
Well,
I mean, we just looked at mercy, and all of a sudden we're looking, about bad trees and what happens to them and these houses. And that's a pretty sharp juxtaposition all of a sudden.
We have to kind of look at ourselves.
Oh, sure. But
take the speck off of our eyes.
See, I think that we might want to use these words rather as you know, I don't even want to use the word necessarily as warning, but as gauge, as measurement. I mean, I think it's kind of interesting, the juxtaposition of this, that right after this comes these words, and, you know, this whole kind of way that one can know whether you've got it or not. You'll be like a tree, either fruitful or not fruitful. You'll be like a house with a good foundation or not a good foundation. And it comes down, you know, kind of the summary statement, but the one who hears and does not act is like a man who built a house on the ground without a foundation. When the river burst against it, immediately it fell, and great was the ruin of that house. And again, I think this is it. The way I'd like to read this, because I spent so darn much time and energy in my ministry using these to get other people into shape. I mean, it's just amazing to me how much energy I've spent trying to convince unfruitful trees that they're unfruitful. And the other, I think, to go back and to see if we can't hear these words of Jesus as words of invitation.
I just noticed in verse 27, it says, "But I say to you that listen." That's like a participle. Like you, I say to you, who are listening.
Yeah.
Okay. So all these imperatives that follow, you know, the commands, are addressed to people that are already listening to Jesus.
Yeah.
So, I don't know if that adds anything to the question, the dialogue here.
Well,
sometimes we say these words to people that maybe aren't listening. These are words to the disciples.
The invitation rather than the address to those who aren't bearing fruit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it may well be that the lure, you know, who is it? You know, Soren Kierkegaard has in his book Attacks on Christendom this wonderful little parable about the fishing industry. You know, when Jesus said to the disciples, follow me and I will make you become fishers of people, Kierkegaard said how the church misinterpreted that and went into the canning business and was quite profitable. Had tax deductions. I don't know if you're familiar with Kierkegaard's Attacks on Christendom, but read it only when you're in the best possible mood and not subject to depression at all. Because it's a very depressing book. But he said, you know, he had the suspicion that when Jesus issued that invitation, he intended for the disciples to be the bait. And think about how attractive a community would be who were listening to Jesus. Think of that. And so I think that's, you know, that's where if we're listening, we'll be this kind of...
You know, in Hebrew, there's no word for obey. There's no word in the Old Testament for obey. It's the word hear.
Hear, yeah.
Okay.
I have more evidence here. thank
Greek,
you, Roberto.
There's no word for obey either. We translate ekupakuo, yeah, is like for listening.
Right, listening.
That's what we translate in our English Bible for obey.
Yeah. Another case made. Okay. In order to get into Acts, I'm just going to skip a whole bunch of stuff. But you could look at chapter 8 and chapter 11 and some other places in Luke. Oh, one thing I can't skip because of Jim's observation about so much for being afraid. Turn to chapter 12.
Okay,
no, we're Luke. Thank you for keeping me honest. I do have actually people who've kind of assumed in my Bible studies back home, they kind of, there's Sandy usually fills it in the evening, Tuesday evening Bible classes. Well, just where are you? and in my morning Bible class, there's a person who always says, well, wait a minute, what verse are we on now? But anyway, we're in chapter 12. And beginning at verse 22, and we're not going to read this, I'm just going to call this out to you, but Jesus, he said to his disciples, therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life and so on. So don't worry. And then he lays this whole kind of thing out about how God takes care of the birds and the lilies and all that, and he'll take care of you. And then we get down to verse 32. I've loved to lay 32 on people for years, and 33 and so on. But we'll look at it for a moment. Do not be afraid, little flock. Why? Because it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give alms. Make purses for yourselves that do not wear out, an unfailing treasure in heaven where no thief comes near and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. I used to preach that you had to hear verse 32 before you could hear verse 33, and I'm not sure that's the right order anymore. I think if we dared 33, we could get to 32. But that's just a playful thinking about it. If we just let go a little bit of some of this stuff, we might be able to hear, do not be afraid. But oftentimes, that second stuff just scares the heck out of us. But if we, it's kind of like, and I use this illustration a lot. I grew up over here in Eastern Washington, 6 miles out of, 13 miles out of the town where there was a swimming pool. So we didn't go to town very often to swim, and all my friends in town would go to the pool every day, and they got to be pretty good swimmers. And I would come, and I got to be older and everything, and they were out there in the deep end, having all kinds of fun and inviting me in. And I thought, I'd better not do that because you could drown. There's that. And the same thing is true, I think, in terms of living this lifestyle that Jesus invites us to. The only way you can learn how to swim in it is to get in there. But if you're sitting on the dock, that water's deeper than your head. And there can't be any fun in that. But I think that's why we're invited into this. And these things don't work necessarily, I think, for some people one way, for other people another way. Now, let's move to Acts 2 for a moment, because we've just come off Pentecost not too long ago. And we could do a little word study here, we could point out how often the word hear or listen appears in this text. And again, most of us know this, so we're not going to spend a lot of time here, but the question is first raised in verse 8, how is it that we hear, each of us, in our own native language? How is it that we hear? Very good question. And then again, at the close of this, in verse 11, in our own languages, we hear them speaking about God's deeds of power. Then verse 22, you that are Israelites, listen to what I have to say. And then Peter preaches his Pentecost sermon. And then when you want to go to verse 37. Now when they heard this, they were cut to the heart and said to Peter and to the other apostles, brothers, what should we do? We were doing a very thorough study of Luke Acts. We would have spent some time in chapter 3 of Luke with the crowds that come to John the Baptist with the same question. And interestingly enough, what John the Baptist tells them to do is essentially what Zacchaeus does in chapter 19 when Jesus finds him. But that's another story for another day. Now, I want to skip down to verse 43. Awe came upon everyone because many wonders and signs were being done by the apostles. All who believed were together and had all things in common. They would sell their possessions and goods and distribute the proceeds to all as any had need. Day by day, as they spent much time together in the temple, they broke bread at home and ate their food with glad and generous hearts, praising God and having the goodwill of all the people. The Lord added to their number those who were being saved. And I think saved means being brought into this wholeness. Going back to Zacchaeus. When Zacchaeus responds to Jesus' self-invitation into his house. And then Zacchaeus gets up and gives this little spontaneous conversion speech about the fact that he's going to give away half of everything he's had, and if he's defrauded anybody, he's going to restore it fourfold. I often think about what Mrs. Zacchaeus thought when she was in the kitchen, realizing the Mercedes and everything else was just gone. And she hadn't been consulted. But nonetheless, Jesus says to him, today salvation has come to this house because he too is a child of Abraham. He's back in the family, back in the community, which his own greed and pursuit of tax collecting had cut him off of his community. So I think this whole sense about community is really important in the whole scheme of Acts, or of Luke Acts. Now if you go to chapter 10, so I want to leave just a little bit of time for some discussion. Acts 10 is the story of Cornelius and Peter. And again, we know it quite well. What I think this chapter is about is the education of Peter. Not so much the conversion of Cornelius. And so, just again to pick up some specific things about hearing in this, pick up verse, this is Acts 10, verse 22. They answered, Cornelius, a centurion, an upright and God-fearing man who is well spoken of by the whole Jewish nation, was directed by a holy angel to send for you to come to his house and to hear what you have to say. So Peter invited them in and gave them lodging, and then he goes and he and Cornelius have this discussion in which, like in verse 28, he said to them, you yourselves know that it is unlawful for a Jew to associate with or to visit a Gentile, but God has shown me that I should not call anyone profane or unclean. And remember, this is the Peter who was in the dream, and three times he had to be told, get up and eat. I don't eat anything that's unclean. You don't call anything unclean that I tell you to eat. Now get with it, Peter. Then notice what Peter says, and this is so, I just love this. This is supposed to be Peter instructing Cornelius, right? But he's had a little education along the way himself. And so he says in verse 39, then Peter began to say to them, I truly understand that God shows no partiality. But in every nation, anyone who fears him and does what is right is acceptable to him. You know the message he sent to the people of Israel, preaching peace by Jesus Christ. He is Lord of all. And we, you know, we could have looked at Acts 8 and the Ethiopian eunuch and to find out there's some listening stuff going on in that. And kind of every time the church crosses a boundary in the book of Acts, there's some listening that goes on. And I think one of the ways to read the book of Acts is how they were called to cross all these boundaries that separated peoples in the ancient world. Racial boundaries, the Ethiopian eunuch, of course, being castrated, would not have been able to, he would have been deformed, and so therefore, both in terms of his being a foreigner he would have been unable to get into the closest precincts in temple worship, and all of that is overwhelmed by this gospel that comes by this listening that it's called for. If we had time, we'd look at Acts 17. We don't. Acts 17 is a very interesting chapter because there are two Pauline sermons in it. And in the first sermon, Paul is preaching to Jews, and he uses Bible verses to prove his point. In the second half of it, he's preaching in Athens, and he uses not one Bible verse. It looks like he doesn't do too well in either case as far as making a lot of converts. But if you read on, you begin to see even in the preaching in the synagogue that doesn't look terribly successful, we'll get a list of synagogue leaders and others who do come to the faith. So never is there this rejection totally in Israel, but there is this movement to a new and larger inclusive community. So the thesis I'm trying to promulgate here is that to listen to Jesus leads to this larger community, a more inclusive community, and that the community itself then becomes the evangelist. And that's why the tragic separations that we find among us as human beings and among us as church are such a scandal, I think, to the gospel. Okay, I'll stop now and we'll spend a couple minutes in any conversation and filling in the gaps and all that, because as I say, there's some other interesting listening stuff here we could have looked at. But.
So there's this thing, you know, the Acts 10 has been, is probably part of the sacred canon, like within a canon for gay and lesbian Christians because of Peter's dream. And I think what's so interesting is that, you know, Peter is called to do something that's utterly inconceivable to him as a faithful person, as a righteous person, to eat these unclean foods. It wouldn't be just a matter of technicality. It'd be something that's just utterly disgusting and revolting. The thought of it probably made him gag. And, you know, I work with my students in religion. One, we talk about purity issues, and it's so easy to see other people's as ridiculous, but our own is kind of strange. So I always have to come up with examples that would make people gag in our own. I'll spare you them this morning. But it's this call to inclusivity. Part of what's so radical is that it is how to discern between what are the inappropriate boundaries, you know, that shouldn't stand in the way of inclusivity, but are through custom or habit or whatever are so deeply ingrained in us that the thought of overturning them is just kind of inconceivable, like Peter eating the unclean foods. And what are the boundaries that are appropriate, that are not of this world versus this world, and how do you discern between them? And that's, I think, where so much of the infighting of Christians happens, because each side is absolutely convinced that without these boundaries, the church will fall, or these are the boundaries of the world that are inappropriate for dividing us.
Good, that's a good observation. If you, there's a, the, I think, a helpful book that deals with a lot of that, William Countryman's Dirt, Greed, and Sex. I really think that book really gets at a lot of those kind of issues and in a really profound way. And, you know, it's interesting because the one issue about that the church really seemed to be pretty clear on, and I think Acts 10 continues that, in Mark 7, when Jesus went through the thing about, you know, I don't know what you're so uptight about food, Ari, he says, because you eat something and it goes through your stomach and passes out and goes into the latrine and that's that. And then Mark says, in case you didn't notice it, he just declared all food clean.
It does?
Huh?
It does actually say parentheses?
No. Well, our Bibles put Mark's thing, thus he declared all foods clean. That is in our English Bibles, but it's probably an appropriate kind of aside that Mark wanted to make sure that we didn't miss the point about what Jesus was saying. But on these other issues, and now that we go to Countryman's argument, Jesus did not declare, like on issues of sexual orientation and all that, Jesus never made any statements. So now what are you left with? And then he comes up with the neighbor ethic. And it's interesting about the neighbor ethic, and I saw this book in the bookstore, which I found really a helpful book, The Promise of Lutheran Ethics. You know, we didn't think we had any, and I found that. Are you guys?
Yeah, I read it.
Yeah, and it's really I think a very helpful reclaiming, and Larry's got some stuff. It's good. Stuff. And so anyway, that was a helpful insight and then some ramblings about it, so. Other things that any...
Yeah, one more, Charlie. When I teach the Bible at Luther, we normally get through Acts 5, or at least part of what we read is Acts 5 with Ananias and Sapphira. And, you know, we've been talking about do not be afraid and listening, and Ananias and Sapphira are two members of the community that sold a piece of property and with his wife's knowledge kept back some of the proceeds and only brought a part of it and laid it at the apostles' feet. Peter confronts him and suggests to Ananias that in fact he's only, you know, he hasn't brought it all, he's kept some of it, and when Ananias is confronted by it, he dies. He dies immediately before the feet of Peter. And then Sapphira comes later, and Peter confronts her, and he says, look, the feet of the men who carried your husband away and buried him are standing at the door, and they are waiting for you, and she dies. What's the point of that text?
Well, you teach it.
No, I'm not teaching it today, you are.
Well, when I always try to teach that just before we take the offering. The way I read that text, it really has to do with the violation of the community. I think it is not necessarily that they held back a portion, but that they were not truthful about it. I often wonder how the text would have read if, well, we got $100 for it, but we're only giving 50, how that would have worked. Because it seems to me, whatever else the text is about, it is about a violation of the community. And when you drop dead for violating it, you've raised the ante about as high as you can get it. But I think that its import for us is how sacred the community ought to be, how sacredly we ought to hold our commitments to it. I mean, that's the only way I can make any sense of it. You sure wish they'd had some kind of reprieve or whatever, that there had been a little, if Jesus is about compassion and forgiveness, that they'd gotten another shot at it.
But see, that's the interesting thing, because it isn't Peter that says you should die, and it isn't God that affects their death. They just seem to die on their own accord, apparently out of shame. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be.
But, and that's sad, that they can't sense the mercy that presumably undergirds their community. But I agree that the issue is about this, not the rule, but the discipline that the community has accepted among themselves, and they violated it and sensed their separation and guilt and apparently. But it's very unusual.
Yeah, and here's where I find James Sanders' kind of sense about to try to get over reading the Bible in terms of some kind of morality, but in other words, as a way of theologizing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, obviously that's a way to get off the hook of these hard questions sometimes. But by saying, well, the theological point here is community and so on and so forth. But it's still troubling. And again, that's one of the reasons I think that to always ask the question or have the question in the back of our minds, how does the Bible work? You know, and this is why I really am thankful that by God's grace I'm not a fundamentalist. Mm-hmm. You know, I that would be so hard. I mean, what would you do with passages like this? And because of what it does, you know, I mean, what theology has to grow out of that. And, you know, the danger and the thing that we're always, I think, again, need to be cognizant of, I bring my little box, better metaphor would be, I bring my picture frame, and I'm always putting it on these scenes. When you do that, just look, put your hands like that and see how much is outside of the picture frame. Now we need that to make sense of the world, but as soon as that becomes utterly rigid and impenetrable, then think of where we are. I mean, there's no chance then to have a lot larger picture frame. And the trick is how we, you know, like Luther's dictum that everything has to drive Christ. I think that's usually helpful. But I think it can be not helpful at all sometimes in reading what God is up to because of who we think Jesus is. And so how does that, you know, how does that picture frame get adjusted by what we see in the picture? You know, I don't know how that works. Okay, well, thank you. Tomorrow we're going to do some stuff with Isaiah, just again playfully, because it's, and that, as I say, that book by Sawyer is just so wonderful to just start playing with your frame.